From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Russian President Vladimir Putin told the world that Russia had Chechnya under control. Then, last night, a group of Chechen rebels, who call themselves a suicide squad, took 700 hostages in a Moscow theater. And Chechnya's demand for freedom has brought terrorism center stage in Putin's Russia. Tonight, On Point, terrorism, Chechnya, and the global war on terror. We begin with the latest from Moscow. More than 40 armed men and women have commandeered the theater and threatened to shoot or blow up their hostages unless Russia ends its occupation of Chechnya. I spoke with Michael Wines, Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times, and asked him for the latest on Moscow's hostage crisis.
Well, it has been relatively quiet for the last several hours, as far as we know. There were 11 hostages released during the day today, bringing to a total, I think, of 37, the Russians say, for the entire crisis. Unfortunately, there was also one woman who was released dead, apparently shot in the initial takeover when she tried to escape. The hostage takers released her body to two Jordanian doctors today. She'd been shot in the chest and had several broken fingers, they say. Tonight, the only development that we know of, aside from some sporadic efforts at negotiations, has been that they apparently have divided the hostages up and put them in separate rooms in the music hall, the performance hall, where they're being held. Some people say that's in anticipation of an attack, but I don't think anybody really has a clear idea of what's going to happen from here on.
Michael Wines, what's our best understanding at this point of who's inside the hall among the hostages, among the hostage takers?
Among the hostages, they now say that there are roughly 700 people. They don't quite know the exact number. It is a mix of people. I'm told, and I have not verified this, that this was the beginning of the second year of this play, and as a result, there were a number of VIPs in the audience. We don't know if they escaped or if they've been taken hostage. They say that there are about 40 school children and their teachers who are attending an evening performance of this popular play called Nord-Ost. There are some 75 foreigners, a good number of them Ukrainians, but among them some British, Austrian, Dutch citizens, and three Americans and one American green card holder. And, of course, there are a lot of Russians. Among the hostage takers,
yes.
They are all Chechens. They said today that there were 25 men, 25 women. They have described themselves as members of a suicide brigade with an odd name, which, as far as I know, has never been heard before. They've called themselves the 29th Division, and they claim to be working for the commander of Chechen forces. What is clear is that they're fanatics, and in fact, they appear to have delivered a tape to the Moscow Bureau of Al Jazeera, which you may know is the famous Arabic station that has broadcast tapes from Al-Qaeda leaders in the past. And in that tape, two tapes actually, they make a pledge. Basically, one of them makes a pledge to die and to take hundreds, what they call hundreds of infidels with them.
Michael Wines, is this a new message or tone from Chechen rebels? Is there a new edge here? It's not the first time there's been hostage taking. It's not the first time there's been the threat, and eventually in other cases, delivering on lots of death.
No, it's not. And in a lot of ways, the tactics are not different from what has been seen over the last 10 years or so of war in Chechnya. What's different, I guess, is the timing. There was a hostage taking at a southern Russian hospital in 1995 or 1996 that proved devastating to the morale of the Russian forces. It was one of the key factors in ending the war back then, first war. They also occupied a town in Dagestan and essentially took hostage 2,000 people, also in the mid-1990s. So that's not really new. There have been a lot of these sorts of episodes over the years. What's new and what is especially devastating is that this incident has taken place in the center of Moscow, literally weeks after President Putin has assured Russian citizens that Chechnya is now under control, that rebuilding of the country and reconciliation was ready to start, and that the guerrillas had been reduced to a sort of ragtag band. Regardless of how this tragedy ends, it has really destroyed the illusion that this war is in any sense over, And in that sense, it's been, I think, particularly devastating to the government.
What do Putin's options appear to be at this point?
None of them appear very good. A military response, which is the way he has pursued this conflict for the last 3 years, most people, I think would end in a real tragedy with lots of deaths. The guerrillas have wired this music hall with explosives, wired themselves with explosives. They have grenade launchers, apparently. They have automatic rifles. It's a true arsenal. And there would undoubtedly be mayhem if they assaulted the building. On the other hand, politically, Mr. Putin faces a real problem if he decides to adhere to their demands and somehow begin some movement out of Chechnya or perhaps even negotiations to end the war. You know, he's established a political reputation in part by being a tough guy on Chechnya. And to reverse that now in the face of pressure by terrorists certainly carries at least some political risks with it.
Do these guerrillas embrace the label terrorist, or do they see themselves as freedom fighters?
You know, the old saying, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. I don't think they've really specifically addressed that question. What they have said and what they said in the Al Jazeera tape, in fact, that was released today, was that they're fighting Russian oppression, that they have tried to make humanity realize the situation of the Chechen people, but that humanity has not paid any attention, and that this is their way of getting attention.
And finally, Michael Wines, how important is Washington's position on this hostage-taking and on the Chechen question overall?
I don't think the American position on this hostage-taking is very important at all to the Russians. The reverse, in fact, might be true. The Russian handling of this situation could have a significant effect on American policy, particularly if it weakens Mr. Putin, because Mr. Putin is about the best thing the United States has going in Russia right now, a man who is willing to work with the United States in a government that in many ways below Mr. Putin is hostile. And so the weaker Mr. Putin becomes, the more difficulty the United States has in pressing its own objectives in this part of the world, and maybe in fighting the war on terrorism. How Mr. Putin handles this crisis is of immense interest, I think, to the United States.
Michael Wines, thank you for joining us.
Not a problem.
Michael Wines is Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times. He spoke with me 2 hours ago from Moscow. Last September, President Putin was at the head of the line to pledge Russia's support in the U.S. war on terror. Now, President Bush has called Putin to offer support in a, quote, time of solidarity between the United States and Russia. But terrorism has put Chechnya and its claims back on the map. Is terror the new language of global statecraft? The one clear dividing line distinguishing friends from enemies? Or is there room for U.S. sympathy, even now, for the Chechen cause? Are these Chechen rebels terrorists or freedom fighters or both? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me tonight from Washington is Anatole Levin. He's senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Chechnya, Tombstone of Russian Power. Good evening and welcome, Anatole Levin.
Good evening.
Thanks for being with us. Also with us from Hanover, New Hampshire tonight is On Point News analyst Jack Beattie, senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly Magazine. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom. Hello to our guest.
Anatole Levin, there's so much to talk about tonight, but take us back for a moment, if you will. Give us the thumbnail history that will help us understand this bitter conflict that has now exploded in the middle of Moscow. What is the Chechen sore that Russia just can't figure out what to do about?
Well, like many other Muslim areas, Chechnya was incorporated first in the Russian Empire and then in the Soviet Union by conquest. The Chechens suffered very badly in the process, particularly, of course, in the deportation to Central Asia by Stalin.
Of huge portions of their population.
Yes, from 1944 to 1957. And although Khrushchev later allowed them to go home.
This is from Siberia, is that correct?
Or? Mostly from Kazakhstan.
Kazakhstan, excuse me.
That was never forgotten. Mm-hmm. And so when the Soviet Union collapsed or began to collapse, the Chechens basically struck out for full independence, or at least the armed radicals among them did so. And that led to the first Russian military intervention of 1994 to 96, which ended in effect with Russian defeat and withdrawal.
And for a time, the appearance that Chechnya had won that independence.
Yes, there were 3 years of de facto independence, not, of course, internationally recognized, but in which the Chechens ran their own affairs with no presence of Russian troops or police. The problem is that that period was extremely disastrous. The economy had been wrecked by the First War.
Mm-hmm.
There were thousands of unemployed, heavily armed young men running around.
Mm-hmm.
The result was an explosion of kidnapping directed against not just Russians, but Westerners and other Muslims in the region,
mm-hmm.
which claimed up to 2,000 victims.
Enter Vladimir Putin.
Yes, and well, the other problem you see was that during the First War, as in the case of Kashmir, this conflict had been exploited by international Islamists linked to al-Qaeda,
mm-hmm.
who really turned Chechnya into a base.
Is there no question about the al-Qaeda link? Is that beyond question?
Well, al-Qaeda announced it itself,
mm-hmm.
that it was sending volunteers and money
mm-hmm.
to Chechnya.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, this is not to say that that the Chechen struggle has been dominated by, international extremists.
But the link is there. Russia was unhappy. Vladimir Putin rode that unhappiness in no small part to power.
Yes, exactly.
So in 1999, Putin comes in, and in the years since, what's been the story in Chechnya?
Well, I mean, in response to an invasion of Russian territory by these extremists and their Chechen allies, and in response to terrorism in Moscow or elsewhere, responsibility for which has never been adequately established,
mm-hmm.
but still was attributed by Russia.
These are the apartment bombings in Moscow and so on.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
Russia launched a military reoccupation of Chechnya in October 99. Which was initially relatively successful in crushing the major armed Chechen resistance, but since then has just settled down into a very bloody and ugly guerrilla and terrorist war.
So what's your assessment, Anatol Levin? Are the Chechens freedom fighters? Are they terrorists? Are they both? Do they belong in the sights of the U.S. global war on terror?
Well, they're like the Palestinians or the Kashmiris, you know, or a number of other people around the world. They're people with a national cause who have, in part, turned to terrorism as a way of trying to further that national cause. There's no doubt that the Chechens have used terrorist methods.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, as in all these cases, this is... an example of the fact that it's not possible to use terrorism as if it indicated a movement or an ideology. Terrorism is just a tactic.
And yet, Jack Beatty, George W. Bush has defined a global struggle in terms of terrorism, with terrorism as the dividing line.
Yes, he has. And it, in some ways, it reminds me of the Cold War when some American strategists thought there was something called international communism. Just as today, they see one terrorism. Well, we know, looking back, that there wasn't international communism. There were communisms, and some of them wore nationalist garb and indeed were nationalist essentially, as in Vietnam. And our fighting against all of them, all of the time, resulted in all sorts of policy tragedies even. But it's interesting, tonight, as Vestia is quoting an unnamed U.S. official who's saying that this hostage-taking is part of a coordinated international strike by international terrorism. You know, what happened in Bali, the tanker, threats in America. So there you are, this terrorism with local roots being framed as part of this international, single monolithic enemy. Terrorism.
And who knows, many things can be true at once. We're talking this hour about Chechnya and the hostages in Moscow, about the Russian theater in the war on terrorism. You can join the conversation. Do you see the Chechens as terrorists or freedom fighters or both? Should Russia let Chechnya go? Or can Washington not side with the Kremlin when 500 or more civilians are hostage in a theater wired to explode? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Chechnya and the hostages in Moscow, about the Russian theater in the war on terrorism. My guest tonight is Anatol Levin. He's senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and author of Chechnya, Tombstone of Russian Power. You can join us as well. Does the use of terrorism negate any cause, no matter how justified that cause might be? Does it cancel our sympathy? Or is this where the war on terror threatens to align us with oppression? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Anatol Levin, how do you see this? We have a global war on terror announced. Russia has been a staunch ally in that, extraordinarily helpful in the U.S. effort in Afghanistan. Does the U.S. have any choice now but to be equally supportive of the Kremlin when you have hundreds of Russians and others wired to blow up in the middle of Moscow?
I think that America has to support Russia on this. It would be totally inconsistent not to do so.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, I think that America certainly should urge Russia to try to address the political and national causes of this struggle. Now, that isn't going to be easy. Negotiating with the Chechen side is not easy at all. There's no guarantee that there will be enough Chechens who actually want compromise. Nonetheless, I mean, it's perfectly clear that, once again, just as in Kashmir or in Palestine, the existing Russian struggle is not working. Now, the one thing I would say, mm-hmm. though, is that if the U.S. is going to be consistent in this matter, then it must be consistent above the board.
What do you mean by that?
Well, what I mean is that if it's going to recognize that the Chechen struggle is complicated and is not just about terrorism, that there are legitimate national goals here as well, mm-hmm. it has to do the same in the case of Palestine and it has to do the same in the case of Kashmir. If it doesn't, then I think Russians will very legitimately think that they are being singled out by the U.S. for special and hostile treatment.
So you're saying it would look like real politic elsewhere, but moralism in regard to Russia?
Yes, well, or it would look like realpolitik directed against Russia, mm-hmm. as to some extent it was before September the 11th.
Mm-hmm.
Because, we'd look a lot better today with regard to Chechnya if more Westerners had recognized before September the 11th that Russia had a real problem.
Is there a clear case of where justice lies here, Anatol Levin, in your view, in terms of what Russia ought to be doing morally, let's say, with Chechnya?
No, it's not clear at all. During the first war from 94 to 96, I thought that morally it was pretty clear-cut. I thought that Russia should simply get out and leave the Chechens to themselves, and that war was very much the fault of the then Russian government of Boris Yeltsin.
And why is it muddier now? Chechens say that what they want is freedom and please let us go.
Yeah, but when the Chechens had that freedom from 96 to 99, they used it in the most disastrous fashion. They became a real menace to the entire region because of the way in which Chechnya was used as a base, as they say, not just for massive criminality and kidnapping, but also for Islamist extremism aimed at spreading Islamic revolution across the region. I think, therefore, that the Russian invasion of 1999, although the consequences, of course, have been equally disastrous, was a great deal more justified than the Russian invasion of 1994.
What have the consequences of Russian intervention in the first and second instance been?
The first war wrecked the economy and really drew international Islamic extremists into Chechnya. When I went to Chechnya in the early 1990s before the war, there was very little serious presence of these international radicals. Mm-hmm. That was very much a product of the war of 94 to 96. And the second war, of course, has led to a real quagmire in which, even by official figures, more than 4,000 Russian troops have been killed, and a much larger number of Chechen fighters and, above all, Chechen civilians.
60,000, we read? Is that a number that you've seen?
I'm sorry?
60,000 Chechens?
No, I think that's much too high,
uh-huh.
Much too high,
mm-hmm.
at least to judge by my investigation in the first war.
Mm-hmm.
These kind of figures are grossly exaggerated.
Do you have any sense then?
I'd say perhaps in the low tens of thousands.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
The point is that with rare exceptions, the Russians have not engaged in massacres, as, you know, it's not like Bosnia. But undoubtedly, I mean, they've conducted an extremely brutal campaign. Like previous colonial armies, in which many civilians have been illegally killed, others have been maltreated, and in general, the Russian army has behaved, I must say, disgracefully.
Jack Beatty, the Chechens in the theater, perhaps before they went in, somehow got a tape to Al Jazeera, the Arab satellite television news network, on which they say humanity has not paid attention. This is our way to get the attention of the world to our cause, which raises the banner we mentioned earlier, the notion that perhaps somehow we've come to the point that terrorism itself is the new language of discussing international disputes, internal disputes, any kind of dispute. You don't get credibility. You don't get attention unless you have violence.
That seems to be the case, and Mr. Levin can correct me on this, but as I work it out, it looks like in the past, their taking of hostages actually worked.
Yes.
So they're reverting to a tactic that worked in the past, but they're doing it this time in the center of Moscow. Terrorism is the way that furiously empowered minorities who represent, if not in their in any delegated way, then in a way that they sort of reflect serious injustices, get the world's attention by bombs, by hostage taking, by this seems to be the new language of the disempowered in the world. And September 11th was part of that. This is part of that. Bali. I mean, and each time these things are reported, of course, there's the infection quality. You know,
and up it ratchets.
Yeah. Other people will see it. This is how you get attention in the world, and the innocent suffer.
Anatole Levin, is this the new lingua franca? Do you see it that way? And if it is, what's the message to the United States?
Well, you know, this language has been around for some decades by now. The Palestinians took to terrorism starting in the early 1970s for exactly the same reasons. They thought that it was the only way that they would ever get anybody to pay attention to their plight and their demands.
But those hijackings now look like almost child's play compared to the numbers, the scale, and the frequency that we see terrorism today.
Well, that's true, of course. I'm afraid the example is spreading. And, of course, the dreadful example of terrorism by suicide, suicide bombing and suicide kidnapping.
Which the Chechens in the music hall in Moscow have announced is their mission, their readiness.
Well, exactly. Which, of course, gives a vastly added dimension of ruthlessness and of potential damage, you know, compared to terrorists of the past who, you know, hope themselves to survive.
Anatole, Jack, stand by. A lot of callers want to join us. Let's invite them in. Tom is on the line. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
How are you guys doing today?
Well, thank you.
I actually had a cousin who was kidnapped in Chechnya and then ransomed off by Doctors Without Borders. He was then ransomed off. So I've had...
Hello, Tom. Are you there?
Yes, I am still there. Can you hear me?
Yes, come on.
In the first war, the Russians, I mean, I think they kind of basically wanted Chechnya for the gas and oil. They screwed up the whole... such that
Tom, you're breaking up for honest. Let me ask you this. Do you see the Chechens as freedom fighters or terrorists?
Both. It's not so. It's just too easy to call one or the other.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're both. They're terrorists. They're going to kill innocent people. But when someone's left, how do you fight someone who's as strong as Russia when you're as little as Chechnya? The
mm-hmm.
only way you can do it is by killing innocents.
Tom, you're breaking up, so I'm going to let you go. But thanks for your call. Anatole Levin, where does, in your view, this leave the United States? The Chechens have clearly crossed the line in terms of terrorism, and this is terrorism by any definition going on in the middle of Moscow. On the other hand, you and our caller Tom describe a case that the Chechens have to bring to the world at the same time.
Well, the U.S. has to support Russia against terrorism, and it has to support Russian territorial integrity. I mean, clearly, if the U.S. gets into the business of supporting separatist movements, whether in Russia or elsewhere, then it is, you know, really undermining any kind of international law and international order. That said, I think that the U.S. should certainly try to play a part in bringing both the Russian government and, you can't really call it a government, but anyway, the followers of President Aslan Maskhadov to the negotiating table.
This is the government out of power, the one that was there in the interim 3 years.
That's right. The problem is, though, that as soon as you say that, the Russians reply, but look, Maskhadov does not control his followers. It's very unlikely, for example, extremely unlikely, that Maskhadov is in any way behind this kidnapping in Moscow. This is being carried out by, you know, completely independent elements. And therefore, the Russians say, what is the point of talking to Maskhadov? You know, we do a deal with him, we make all kinds of concessions, we withdraw our troops, and then exactly the same thing happens, as happened in 96 to 99, which is that essentially the radicals take over. So this isn't by any means straightforward. At the same time, if there is ever going to be peace in that part of the world, and if Russia is to be spared this kind of attack, then ultimately there has to be some kind of deal between the Russian government and forces which can represent at least a significant portion of the Chechen people.
Anatoly Levin, stand by. I want to welcome into our conversation Loma Usmanov. He recently had a letter in the Washington Post which describes him as a representative of the government of President Aslan Maskhadov, the president out of power in Chechnya. Good evening and welcome, Loma Usmanov.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for being with us. Loma Usmanov, you are residing in the United States now, but as a Chechen, when you look at what's going on in Moscow right now, what do you see? What's your view of the hostage taking there?
I want you to know my position, and my position, position of, I think, all educated Chechens, and I'm sure I'm presenting position of 99.99% of Chechen population. We deeply, strongly condemn, I would say it's even these polite words, or all this terrorist activity of people who took hostages. Totally. There's no question about that. We condemned, I think, very much than any one of the speakers here and through this broadcasting, for because it's against our nation. But at the same time, I would like to disagree with some points presented by Anatoly Levin.
All right.
Totally disagree with some points, and I think he doesn't understand very well issue what's happening in Chechnya, especially between the wars. And in 3 points, I totally disagree with him. He said he advocates for Russia. He's since recently become advocate for Russian defending everywhere Russia, and reducing, by all means, trying to reduce suffering victims of Chechnya. Even today, he said that the number of victims less than 10,000, which has nothing to do with reality. And I'm our figures based on independent human rights organization, even Russian organization, Russian politicians.
So you're saying there's been more death?
Much more.
All right, and your other 2 points?
Altogether, more than 200,000. At very least, for two wars.
Well, there's a lot of blood, so we'll take your point there. Your other points?
Yes, other point is the key mistake, in my opinion, that Anatoly Levin doesn't take into account human rights of Chechen population, political rights of Chechen people. He doesn't want to take into account that Chechens are suffering for 200 years from Russia, and this war and what's happening now, it is a clear result of Russian policy in Chechnya.
And your final point there, Loma.
Yes, Russia doesn't conduct war against terrorism. Russia policy in Chechnya is clearly to produce terrorism in Chechnya. We expressed that opinion many times already, and we're just surprised that it's happened now. It could happen much earlier.
Loma Usmanov, we've got it. One moment, please. I'm Tom Ashbrook. Loma Usmanov, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. You can join us at 1-800-423-8255. Shantanu is on the line. Hi, Shantanu. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hello.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call. I had... I'll divide my comments into two parts. first part is about the incident in Moscow and my thoughts on that. And the second part would be about the parallels that have been drawn between Chechnya and Kashmir.
Shantanu, please cut straight to the heart of it. We don't have much time before the break.
All right. First of all, irrespective of what the goal is, freedom or whatever, I strongly believe that the means in this case are not justified. It's difficult.
Whose means? The Chechens or the Russians?
The Chechens. The use of violence to, you know, take hostages and kill innocent civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Right at this moment, I'm sure there is a mother who's trapped inside, and the child is outside wondering whether he or she will see their mother one.
And
one
many
more time.
Children were told inside with parents trapped outside. And your observation on the parallel between Chechnya and Kashmir.
Yes, I think the parallel is largely inaccurate because in Kashmir the problem is caused by terrorists from Pakistan who have infiltrated Kashmir at this point of in time. There are only three types of people living in Kashmir or trying to live in Kashmir. A, people who just cannot leave. That's a very, very small minority.
Mm-hmm.
B, the Indian security forces. And C, the terrorists. The people of Kashmir have already fled from Kashmir.
Mm. Shantanu, we've got your point. I want to put it first to Loma Usmanov. Loma, what's your sense? Do you see Chechnya's circumstances as parallel, as Anatole Levin has said, to those of Kashmiris or Palestinians?
No, I don't see any parallels. Chechen has its own history with Russia, as many features which distinguish Chechnya from Kashmir and Palestine. And I don't know, should I talk details or just I can't see anything common.
Mm-hmm.
It's a total different history.
So, creation
of the problem and how problem is going on.
But why are we back to terrorism here?
Just because for 3 years we were asking, let's stop the war, let's talk with Moscow, who was in the beginning especially every day very, very open for conversation, very pro-Western. We were asking. Now nobody wants to pay attention. Now we received Baraev.
And
now,
what should the United States be doing, in your view?
United States, I think... first of all, I totally agree with the point with all speakers that no question about this is a terrorist action. The United States should condemn and support Russia in that particular case. But as a whole, should be something reviewed towards Chechnya. I think it's mistaken, just blinded to say, like once Colin Powell said in Rome two, 3 months ago, this is no question about this is war against terrorism. This is not the truth. This is not the case. This war produced terrorism. That's our opinion. It's not our opinion. Many independent observers and Russians, many people have the same opinion.
Loma Usmanov, we've got it. We thank you for joining us tonight. We're talking tonight about Chechnya and the hostages in Moscow, the Russian theater in the war on terrorism. Is this the case that tests the distinction between freedom fighter and terrorist? Or can that question even be asked when hundreds of lives are at stake? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about Chechnya and the hostages in Moscow, the Russian theater in the war on terrorism. As we speak tonight, hundreds, as many as 700 Russians and others, are hostage in a Moscow music hall. The hall, we're told, is wired with explosives, wired to blow if Russian authorities should try to go in. Dead bodies have come out. No one knows how the standoff is going to end, but terrorists have put the Chechnya issue back on the map. Is terrorism simply the way we talk to each other now? Is it the new shared language of conflicting interests? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Our guest tonight is Anatole Levin. He's author of Chechnya, Tombstone of Russian Power. And right now on the line, Imran. Welcome, Imran. You're on the air.
Hi there. I'm going to try and make 3 quick points.
Mm-hmm.
I think that on the global level, I think what we see here is what happens when you have massive state power basically crushing, a society like the Chechens or perhaps the Kashmiris by the Indian government or perhaps Uyghurs in Western China.
But Imran, we had a civil war in the United States to hold the war together when a southern population didn't like the way the majority was looking at the world.
Well, and look what the result was. I mean, it was
a unified United States that a century and more later people seemed pleased with.
Well, I think that was after a lot of bloodshed. But I think the point I wanted to make on this was that, you know, you have the Russians who basically flattened Grozny, and the end result is that the Chechens themselves have nothing left but to take up arms. And so when we look at, you know, terrorism, you say they're resorting to bombs and bullets. You know, I would have to ask, well, what was the means that the Russians have used? Bombs and bullets and helicopters. And I think if you want to know where the next, round of terrorism is going to come out of, it's going to be those countries where we've supported governments that strong-arm local populations into submission, and they fight back. And it'll be Central Asia, you know, maybe Tajikistan or Kyrgyzstan or someplace like that where, you know, we're pumping money into supporting the same Politburo members of the Soviet Union who now claim to be democratic leaders, or it's going to be the Uyghurs. And I think the disappointment of American policy is that we cut a deal with every one of the world powers who had their own dirty secret. Actually, it's not a secret, but does no one choose to pay attention? And we turn a blind eye just for the sake of our own war and terrorism.
Imran, we've got your point, and I thank you for your thoughts. Anatol Levin, let me put that to you. What do you make of Imran's analysis here? I guess if you take that to its full extension, any population, I guess ethnic population under a large country that wants out would have to go.
Well, yes, basically. But also, unfortunately, for a whole set of reasons, to do with America's role in the Middle East, to do with America's support for Israel, America does now find itself a target of attack by Islamist terrorists, the most devastating of which attacks was, of course, September the 11th. Now, in my view, this is very unfortunate and perhaps even in its origins unnecessary, but it's a fact. There is a war now going on, and clearly in this war, America will find it very difficult to distinguish between one set of Islamist terrorists and others, when clearly we see that Al-Qaeda and its allies have spread themselves through a whole set of different conflicts, from the Philippines through Chechnya to Algeria.
So in that sense, you're saying George W. Bush is quite right when he describes it as a global war, but you seem to be arguing with the posture the United States takes toward it.
Well, I'm saying that there is a global war going on, precisely, but that the U.S. has to try to cut away the national support from these Islamists. In my view, the Islamists only become really dangerous, or at least they will only be able to survive in the long run, where they are able to gain support from a national struggle, whether in Palestine, Kashmir, Chechnya, or elsewhere. Unfortunately, so far, the U.S. has been very bad at doing that. But this isn't just a failure in the case of Chechnya. It's a failure across the board.
Dawn's calling from Tomah, Wisconsin. Hi, Dawn. You're on the air.
Hello. Well, I really appreciate the things you guys have on your program. Thank you for taking my call.
Good to have you.
My comment, well, it's kind of a comment question, or I don't know how do you want to take it, but
let us have it.
Number one, I think that when you say, you know, is this the language, you know, is this the language, you know, and this for terrorism?
Is terrorism the way we talk to each other now?
Yeah. Is that we need to really take a look at who the terrorist acts are directed at. And it is primarily the people with political, economic, and military power. And that doesn't mean that every single act of terrorism is justified. But I think there is a very realistic basis to the arguments that people have. And
You're suggesting that people are oppressed, I guess, so they push back. But is it right to take down two tall towers in Manhattan? Is it right to blow up 500 civilians in the middle of Moscow, Dawn?
No, I don't agree with that. But the thing is you look at the technology of, you know, look at the technology they use. It's very low tech. It's things that, I mean, look at the planes that crashed into the World Tower. Nobody, I mean, okay,
so what,
yeah,
so what's the answer? What should we take away from that, Dawn?
I think what we need to do is we need to go back and for American policy, I'll give you some sense of my position.
Make it quick.
I'll position myself. I'm Native American, and that's not why I think that we need to view this. But at the same time, I think we need to take a look at what is it that breeds this. That doesn't mean that every single act of terrorism has some real base, justifiable.
We've got it, Dawn, and I thank you for your call. I think we've got it. Anatole Levin, I know we just have you for another second. How do we help Russia, help the Chechens defuse this and get it on a better path, we the United States?
Well, I think the U.S. should offer very strongly to mediate, but I also think that talk is very easy from the West. One way of trying to bring about peace in Chechnya is by offering a really substantial package of reconstruction aid to bring about peace. Hmm. But what do we see? We see that even in Afghanistan, a country for which we've taken formal responsibility, the aid is very slow in coming. And has been pretty reluctantly given. So, I mean, when I say this, I don't say it with any confidence at all that such an offer from America or from the West would, in fact, be forthcoming. But I think it would be both moral and in our interest to do so, because I think we can see, above all from this latest incident, how Chechnya, like other national struggles around the world, is in fact feeding the Islamist terrorists who are both our enemies and the enemies of Russia.
Anatole Levin, you've been terrific tonight, and I thank you so much for coming on.
Not at all. Thank you very much.
Anatole Levin is senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He's author of Chechnya, Tombstone of Russian Power. Jack Beattie, Anatole Levin says, pour some development aid into Chechnya. You can imagine how popular that would be in the U.S. Congress. On the other hand, we just saw George Bush put the pin to almost a $400 billion U.S. defense budget. Maybe if you don't pay up front, you pay later.
Yeah, and that's why the sacrifice of human rights short range in the war on terror, which we seem to have been doing by soft peddling human rights issues with Russia and others, is not in our long term interest. Because in the end, of course, these grievances and the Al Qaeda element in them batten on these festering human rights problems, as in Chechnya. You know, it's a remarkable fact that of the 187 suicide attacks worldwide from 1980 to 2001. All of them were against democracies. This doesn't happen against autocracies. It wouldn't have happened in the old Soviet Union. The suicide terrorists attack polities that are vulnerable to punishment, that have political pressure on them. The second thing about them is they've all had nationalist goals, and most of the goals have been to get rid of military forces that are based on their territories. So you're right back to the national issue again, but democracy is the target here.
Well, we hear it. Sympathy to all, and tonight to those in the music hall in Moscow. Jack, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation online. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. With Election Day less than 2 weeks away now, the nation's politicos are focusing their attention on New Hampshire. The race for the Granite State's Senate seat is a virtual dead heat. Some polls have Democratic Governor Jeanne Shaheen slightly ahead. Others show Republican Representative John Sununu with a slim edge. Some political analysts say the race is so close because the candidates share many of the same views. President Bush is wildly popular in New Hampshire, and both candidates have been stumbling over each other to show support for many of President Bush's policies. Shaheen and Sununu squared off in the second of their three debates on Monday night. Here are excerpts from that debate, beginning with a question for Governor Jeanne Shaheen.
With the recent sniper attacks in the Washington area, there's been increased discussion about gun control and the so-called fingerprinting of guns so that you can trace bullets to a particular weapon. As a senator from a state that prides itself on the motto, live free or die, would you support legislation requiring the fingerprinting of guns?
Governor Shaheen?
I think it's very positive that the president is looking into whether the bullet fingerprinting technology is something that would work, and I think we should explore that and see if it will help us solve crimes. But I was governor when Carl Draga shot two state troopers, a judge, and a newspaper editor. And I know that all the laws in the world can't stop a deranged individual.
Congressman?
I think it's a mistake for anyone to use the emotion of this crime spree to advance their political agenda on either side of a gun control debate. Any effort to prevent felons or criminals from getting access to firearms, from committing crimes and to prosecute them, should be based on what technology can and can't accomplish.
Our next question comes from Mike Nikitas, and it will go first to Congressman Sununu.
Congressman Sununu, knowing what you know today, if the president informed the Congress tomorrow that he was attacking Iraq with the purpose of removing Saddam Hussein from power, would you support him and why?
I already have. We voted in a bipartisan way in Congress to give the president the military and diplomatic flexibility to take action that he thinks is essential to enforcing the commitments Saddam Hussein made at the close of the Gulf War for disarmament, for releasing political prisoners, for ending oppression against his people. He's shown a willingness to use chemical weapons against his own people, against other countries. He's invaded Iran. He invaded Kuwait. He poses a unique threat to America's national security. We can't shy away from that very fundamental fact.
Governor Shaheen.
I have supported the president in his efforts to disarm Saddam Hussein. I think Iraq poses a threat to the region. He poses a threat to our interests both abroad and here at home. Saddam Hussein, over the last 11 years, has refused to obey 16 UN resolutions. So I think we do have to leave all of the options on the table, including military force.
Our next question comes from Mike Nikitas, and it will go first to Governor Shaheen.
In 6 years, when your Senate term is up, what is the single most important thing you want to have accomplished in the United States Senate? Please be specific.
Governor Shaheen.
I think we need to get this economy moving again. That would be my focus. I think we need to have tax credits to spur research and development. We need to protect pensions and extend unemployment benefits to people who are out of work. We need to invest in science and technology. We need to invest in education and job training. We do need to keep taxes low, and I supported the Bush tax cut. But I disagree with John Sununu when he talks about simplifying the tax code. I disagree with his approach. He sponsored legislation that would eliminate the home mortgage deduction. Millions of Americans have depended on that home mortgage deduction to be able to buy their homes. That would be, for many people, would mean that they would not be able to afford their own home.
Congressman, if indeed you do want to eliminate the home mortgage deduction, why? And is that legislation still pending for you?
Reforming the tax code means being willing to talk about big ideas, being willing to talk about fundamental reform, not nickel and diming. If you reform the tax code, give all families a very generous, aggressive deduction, $30,000, $35,000 for a family of four, they're going to have more in deductions than they currently have with or without home mortgage interest or other deductions that may be in the tax code. That's real reform. We can work around the edges. And I supported the president's tax cuts, and I support making the president's tax cuts permanent, unlike Jeanne Shaheen.
Excerpts from Monday night's debate between U.S. Senate candidates in New Hampshire, Democratic Governor Jeanne Shaheen, and Republican Representative John Sununu. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR. We're